I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. And today is the deadline imposed by federal judge Dana Sabra of the Southern District of California to finish reuniting the roughly 2,500 children, ages 5 to 17, who were separated from their parents at the border under President Trump's zero-tolerance policy. The government has faced an enormous challenge in its efforts to reunite these families. But Kirstjen Nielsen, the Department of Homeland Security secretary, told Fox News' Brett Baer that she was satisfied with the government's efforts.
Well, we're on track to do it. We're working hand in glove with HHS, and it's certainly our intention to reunify all families that are suitable.
Despite the government's optimistic outlook, they have deemed a significant number of parents ineligible for reunification, and hundreds of parents were reportedly deported ahead of their children. Joining me now is Caitlin Dickerson, an immigration reporter with The New York Times, and she's got the latest developments. Thanks for being with us, Caitlin.
Thanks for having me.
So today's the deadline. I think there's not much of a surprise that many of these kids have not been reunited with their families. Tell us where we stand right now.
So today we expect to see about 1,600 children finally reunified with their families. And those are the kids who have been deemed eligible after background checks and confirmation that people who claim to be their parents actually are, and also confirmation that the parents are still in the United States. But like you pointed out, that leaves almost 1,000 children still in federal custody for a number of reasons. And there's still a lot of work ahead, especially when it comes to those parents who were deported without their children. And the government doesn't know where those parents are right now.
So there's a lot of mess, it sounds, already. I want to go back to this idea of eligibility. Now, these were families who were separated at the border by the Trump administration. And now the administration is saying that these folks are ineligible. Where does that determination come from? Let's start there.
Sure. So ineligibility is a classification that government lawyers came up with to sort of limit the class size of this lawsuit to which this deadline, this very tough deadline, applies. And so there are a wide range of people who are considered ineligible, some of whom everybody sort of agrees, the ACLU who filed the lawsuit and the government, should not be returned to their children. Those are parents who have very serious criminal records, histories of child endangerment, sexual assault, things of that nature. No one's arguing for those children to be reunited with their parents. But certainly there are a lot of people who are deeply concerned about parents who were deported without their children, sort of, you know, the government's own work, and now have been lost somewhere in Central America. Those people, I think the ACLU would like to see have their children back as soon as possible.
And that just sounds traumatic to me. And you've reported on this for the New York Times that 450 migrant parents we're talking about have been deported without their children.
Roughly, yes. I mean, there's one father in Guatemala who I spoke to last week, for example. He's illiterate. He's a potato farmer. He lives in a small town, and he speaks in the indigenous language. And he says he gets his news from the radio. He hasn't received any word from the United States government. He basically calls a consulate in Los Angeles every 4 days to ask for an update about his daughter. She was 5 when she went into custody, and she's turned 6. And he kept asking me over and over again, how long is it going to be until I see her? And of course, I couldn't give him an answer because there isn't an answer right now.
Now, do we know how many parents may have, quote unquote, self-deported, thinking that if they left the United States, this would make it easier for them to perhaps be reunited with their children?
This is a really tricky question. The government hasn't given us a firm answer as to how many parents signed orders of deportation versus how many were not given a choice. But it's also further complicated by this idea that the ACLU filed a motion actually yesterday saying that a lot of parents who signed and agreed to their deportation are now saying they don't know what they signed because the documents they signed weren't translated into their native languages, or they feel they were manipulated or forced to sign under duress. The father in Guatemala I mentioned told me that he was told by a border agent that he would have his daughter back in 2 weeks if he agreed to go home to Guatemala. It had been 4 weeks when I spoke to him, and he still had no news.
And do we know where his daughter is?
His daughter's in New York, and we know that because we're in touch with lawyers representing her as well. But sometimes even when you know where both parties are, there's very little that can be done.
So we heard at the top of the show Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen talking about her views on how successful this has been so far. And I want to play you an additional clip in which she talks about some of the blame and where that should be placed.
Well, the part, it's up to the parents. So if the parents contact us and they would like to be reunited, we, of course, will work with them. But as you know, the way the process works is the parents always have the choice to take the children with them. So these are parents who have made the decision not to bring the children with them, and then we'll continue to work with the court to understand how we can best comply with the order.
Caitlin, it sounds like she's putting the blame on the parents of these children. Is that accurate?
I think when it comes to the question of why we still see so many kids not reunited, it would be hard to place that blame on the parents since the kids were sort of forcibly taken away. And as far as delays go, I mean, we've heard sort of chaotic scenes playing out across the country where children have been sent to the wrong detention facilities, not where their parents actually are, you know, or sent to detention facilities only to then find out that their parents have actually been deported. And in places like Texas, where a lot of reunifications are happening, people are having to wait hours and even sometimes days, more than a week, to be reunited after they're brought to these facilities because there's such a backup, you know, to try to meet this court deadline. So there's a lot of logistical planning that really falls on the government that's happening at the very last moment, if at all. And I think that's responsible for most of the delays we're seeing now.
And we're also hearing about a lot of chaos happening at Port Isabel, where a lot of these reunifications is supposed to be happening. People put on buses without necessarily having enough food or anything. We're definitely going to be continuing to pay attention to this story. Caitlin Dickerson, immigration reporter for The New York Times, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
A little less than 300 miles south of San Antonio is the Port Isabel Processing Center, an immigration facility in Brownsville, Texas, right near the border with Mexico. Debbie Nathan has been reporting on how Port Isabel has been handling the demands of today's deadline, and she joins us now from the Texas border. Debbie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So the Port Isabel Processing Center was designated as the location where mass unification was supposed to happen. What are you seeing?
I'm seeing a lot of disorganization, you know, really to the point of chaos. All kinds of things. Like, one thing is that kids come in from, you know, airplanes at all hours of the day and night, like sometimes at 3 a.m. And a few days ago, they were sleeping in the back rooms of Port Isabel, which is a facility that's only for adults. So that was kind of strange. And then for people who do have kids who've been reunited at Port Isabel, they're commonly taken to Catholic charities or other religious-based shelters, and they get bus tickets generally that their families have paid for, but they don't get anything except maybe a sandwich.
And these are bus tickets to go back to their home country?
No. Okay. These are people who are going to be going to friends or relatives. They've been released with their children. They might be going to something like a place like Rhode Island or California or Florida or North Carolina. So they're facing like a 35 to 48 hour trip. And maybe they've got a sandwich and then that's gone pretty quick. And then this is a mother with kids or a father with kids. And then they've got the rest of this trip with no food and no water and no money, you know, for the next 1 or 2 days.
I want to play a clip of an interview that you did with a woman named Madeline Sandifer. Let's hear what she had to say.
I'm in the parking lot. I'm waiting for them because, you know, standard procedure is that they send the women out in another white van and they bring them to the main entrance. In a minute, I will go back in and see if the guard found out in the meantime whether the little boy is here or not. You know what, Debbie? Hang on a second because I see a white van coming.
Debbie, who's Madeline?
So Madeline is a local person who co-founded a group of mostly women, and they call themselves the Angry Tias and Abuelas. These are volunteers who've taken it upon themselves to try to make reunifications and the exits from Port Isabel more comfortable. So she's actually in this clip. She's outside of Port Isabel. She's been told that a woman is coming out with a 7-year-old boy, and she's getting ready to take that family in her car to a shelter. But she gets to the center, and what she was telling me on the phone was that nobody could tell her if the little boy was there. You know, so it's just another sort of aspect of this chaos. She couldn't get any information about where this child was, or in fact, if he was even there.
And of course, as we mentioned, today's the deadline for reunification. What's your sense of what the next couple of days at Port Isabel will look like?
Well, I think it's going to be pretty much today, you know, what it was. And in the next couple of days, it's going to be extremely chaotic as, you know, the government tries to catch up. It still hasn't reunited everyone. And so then I think once there's a sense that these preliminary reunifications are done, they're going to be sort of playing catch up with people who are coming out of criminal detention. There were a lot of people who were late to get into immigration detention after those mass criminal trials for illegal entry. So there'll be people coming in, you know, who still need to be reunited with their kids. And, you know, there'll be like the TSN Abuela still giving out backpacks at the bus stations. That's what they do. The shelters are still going to be seeing people. You know, and at Port Isabel in the future, we really shouldn't forget this. There's a lot of people who came up without their kids with asylum claims because of the violence they were fleeing in their countries. They're still there. Nobody's really paying attention to them. They've always been the majority of people at places like Port Isabel. So they're going to be suffering in ways similar that these people have, even though they didn't bring their kids. These are parents who left their children behind, but those are still separated families.
Debbie Nathan is a journalist based in Brownsville, Texas. Debbie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.